Recorded Books presents The Mercy of Gods, Book One of The Captive's War, by James S. A. Corey, narrated by Jefferson Mays. Part One. Before. You ask how many ages had the Carracks been fighting the Long War? That is a meaningless question. The Carracks ruled the stars for epochs. We conquered the Asia, and Kuxt, and outdreamt the Eyeless Ones. We burned the Logothetes until their worlds were wind-swept glass. You wish to know of our first encounter with the enemy, but it seems more likely to me that there were many first encounters spread across the face of distance and time, in ways that simultaneity cannot map. The ending, though. I saw the beginning of that catastrophe. It was the abasement of an insignificant world that called itself Asian. You can't imagine how powerless and weak it seemed. We brought fire, death, and chains to Asian. We took from it what we deemed useful to us, and culled those who resisted. And in that is our regret. If we had left it alone, nothing that came after would have been as it was. If we had burned it to ash and moved on, as we had done to so many other worlds, I would not now be telling you the chronicle of our failure. We did not see the adversary for what he was, and we brought him into our home. From the final statement of Ekur Taklal, Keeper Librarian of the Human Moiety of the Carracks. Chapter 1. Later, at the end of things, Dafydd would be amazed at how many of the critical choices in his life seemed small at the time, how many overwhelming problems he had with the distance of time proved trivial. Even when he sensed the gravity of a situation, he often attributed it to the wrong things. He dreaded going to the end-of-year celebration at the Scholars' Common that last time, but not, as it turned out, for any of the reasons that actually mattered. You biologists are always looking for the starting point, asking the origin question, sure, but if you want to see origins, the tall, lanky man at Dafydd's side said, pointing a skewer of grilled pork and apple at his chest. Then, for a moment, the man drunkenly lost his place. If you want to see origins, you have to look away from your microscopes. You have to look up. That's true, Dafydd agreed. He had no idea what the man was talking about, but it felt like he was being reprimanded. Deep sensor arrays. We can make a telescope with a lens as wide as the planet. Effectively as wide as the planet. Wider, even. Not that I do that anymore. Near field. That's where I work now. Dafydd made a polite sound. The tall man pulled a cube of pork off the skewer, and for a moment it looked like he'd drop it down into the courtyard. Dafydd imagined it landing in someone's drink in the common below. After a moment, the tall man regained control of his food and popped it into his mouth. His voice box bobbed as he swallowed. I'm studying a fascinating anomalous zone just at the edge of the heliosphere that's barely a light second wide. Do you have any idea how small that is for conventional telescopy?
I don't, Dafydd said. Isn't a light second actually kind of big?
The tall man deflated.
Compared with the heliosphere, it's really, really small.
He ate the rest of the food, chewing disconsolately, and put the skewer down on the handrail.
He wiped his hand with a napkin before he extended it.
Lauren Morse, Near-Field Astronomic Visualization at Dian Academy. Good to meet you.
Taking it meant clutching the man's greasy fingers in his own. But more than that, it meant committing to the conversation. Pretending to see someone and making his excuses meant finding another way to pass his time. It seemed like a small choice. It seemed trivial.
"Dafydd," he said, accepting the handshake.
When Lauren Morse kept nodding, he added, "Dafydd Alcor." Lauren Morse's expression shifted, a small bunching between his eyebrows, his smile uncertain.
"I feel like I should know that name. What projects have you run?"
"None. You're probably thinking of my aunt. She's in the funding colloquy." Lauren Morse's expression went professional and formal so quickly, Dafydd almost heard the click.
"Oh, yes, that's probably it."
"We're not actually involved in any of the same projects," Dafydd said, half a beat too quickly. "I'm just putting in my time as a research assistant, doing what I'm told, keeping my head down." Lauren Morse nodded and made a soft, noncommittal grunt, then stood there, caught between wanting to get out of the conversation and also to keep whatever advantage the nephew of a woman who controlled the funding purse strings might give him. Dafydd hoped that the next question wouldn't be which project he was working for.
"Where are you in from, then?"
Lauren Morse asked.
"Right here, Irvian," Dafydd said. "I actually walked from my apartments. I'm not really even here for the..."
He gestured at the crowd below them and in the galleries and halls.
"No?
There's a local girl I'm hoping to run into."
"And she'll be here?"
"I'm hoping so," Dafydd said. "Her boyfriend will."
He smiled like it was a joke. Lauren Morse froze and then laughed. It was a trick Dafydd had, disarming the truth by telling it slant.
"What about you? You have someone back at home?"
"Fiancé," the tall man said.
"Fiancé?" Dafydd echoed, keeping his voice playful and curious. They were almost past the part where Dafydd would need to say anything more about himself.
3 years, Lauren Morse said. "We're looking to make it formal once I get a long-term placement."
"Long-term?"
"The position at Dian Academy is just a 2-year placement. There's no promise it'll fund after that. I'm hoping for at least a 5-year before we start putting real roots down."
Dafydd sank his hands in his jacket pockets and leaned against the railing.
"Sounds like stability is really important for you."
"Yeah, sure. I don't want to throw myself into a placement and then have it assigned out to someone else, you know. We put a lot of effort into things, and then as soon as you start getting results, some bigger fish comes in and swallows you."
And they were off. Dafydd spent the next half hour echoing back everything Lauren Morse said, either with exact words or near synonyms, or else pulling out what Dafydd thought the man meant and offering it back. The subject moved from the academic intrigue of Dian Academy to Lauren Morse's parents and how they'd encouraged him into research, to their divorce and how it had affected him and his sisters. The other man never noticed that Dafydd wasn't offering back any information about himself. Dafydd listened because he was good at listening. He had a lot of practice. It kept the spotlight off him. People broadly seemed more hungry to be heard than they knew, and usually, by the end of it, they found themselves liking him, which was convenient even on those occasions when he didn't find himself liking them back. As Morse finished telling him about how his elder sister had avoided romantic entanglements with partners she actually liked, there was a little commotion in the courtyard below. Applause and laughter, and then there, in the center of the disturbance, Tonner Freis. A year ago, Tonner had been one of the more promising research leads. Young, brilliant, demanding, with a strong intuition for the patterns that living systems fell into, and growing institutional support. When Daffod's aunt had casually nudged Daffod toward Tonner Freis by mentioning that he had potential, she'd meant that 10 years down the line, when he'd paid his dues and worked his way to the top, Freis would be the kind of man who could help the junior researchers from his team start their careers. A person Daffod could attach himself to. She hadn't known that Tonner's proteome reconciliation project would be the top of the Medry Council report, or that it would be singled out by the Research Colloquy, High Parliament Review, and the Bastion Group. It was the first single-term project ever to top all three lists in the same year. Tonner Freis, with his tight smile and his prematurely gray hair that rose like smoke from an overheated brain, was, for the moment, the most celebrated mind in the world. From where Daffod stood, the distance and the angle made it impossible to see Tonner's face clearly, or the woman in the emerald green dress at his side, Else Annelies Janin, who had given up her own research team to join Tonner's project, who had one dimple in her left cheek when she smiled, and two on her right, who tapped out complex rhythms with her feet when she was thinking, like she occupied her body by dancing in place while her mind wandered. Else Janin, the research group's second leader and acknowledged lover of Tonner Freis, Else, who Daffod had come hoping to see, even though he knew it was a mistake.
"Enjoy it now," Lauren Morse said, staring down at Tonner and his applause.
The small hairs at the back of Daffod's neck rose. Morse hadn't meant that for him. The comment had been for Tonner, and there had been a sneer in it.
"Enjoy it now?"
But he saw on the tall man's expression that the trick wouldn't work again. Lauren Morse's eyes were guarded again, more than they had been when they'd started talking.
"I should let you go. I've kept you here all night," the tall man said. "It was good meeting you, Alcor."
"Same," Daffod said, and watched him drift into the galleries and rooms. The abandoned skewer was still on the guardrail. The sky had darkened to starlight. A woman just slightly older than Daffod ghosted past, cleaning the skewer away and disappearing into the crowd. Daffod tried to talk himself out of his little feeling of paranoia. He was tired because it was the end of the year, and everyone on the team had been working extra hours to finish the datasets. He was out of place at a gathering of intellectual grandees and political leaders. He was carrying the emotional weight of an inappropriate infatuation with an unavailable woman. He was embarrassed by the not entirely unfounded impression he'd given Lauren Morse that he was only there because someone in his family had influence over money. Any one was a good argument for treating his emotions with a little skepticism tonight. Taken altogether, they were a compelling case. And on the other side of the balance, the shadow of contempt in Morse's voice.
"Enjoy it now."
Daffod muttered a little obscenity, scowled, and headed toward the ramp to the higher levels and private salons of the common, where the administrators and politicians held court. The common was grown from forest coral, and rose 5 levels above the open sward to the east and the plaza to the west. Curvilinear by nature, nothing in it was square. Subtle lines of support and tension, foundation into bracing, into wall, into window, into finial, gave the whole building a sense of motion and life, like some climbing and twisting fusion of ivy and bone.
The interior had sweeping corridors that channeled the breeze, corridors that opened to the sky, private rooms that could be adapted for small meetings or living quarters, wide chambers used for presentations or dances or banquets. The air smelled of cedar and ake trees. Harp swallows nested in the highest reaches and chimed their songs at the people below. For most of the year, the common was a building of all uses for the Irvian Research Medry, and it served all the branches of scholarship that the citywide institution embodied. Apart from one humiliating failure on an assessment in his first year, Daffod had fond memories of the common and the times he'd spent there. The end-of-year celebration was different. It was a nested series of lies, a minefield scattered with gold nuggets, opportunity and disaster invisibly mingled. First, it was presented as a chance for the most exalted scholars and researchers of ASEAN's great medry and research conservatories to come together to socialize casually. In practice, casual included intricate and opaque rules of behavior and a rigidly enforced, though ill-defined, hierarchy of status. And one of many ironclad rules of etiquette was that people were to pretend that there were no rules of etiquette. Who spoke to whom? Who could make a joke and who was required to laugh? Who could flirt and who must remain unreachably distant? All were unspoken, and any mistake was noted by the community. Second, it was a time to avoid politics and openly jockeying for the funding that came with the beginning of a new term. And so every conversation and comment was instead soaked in implication and nuance about which studies had ranked, which threads of the intellectual tapestry would be supported into the next year, and which would be cut. Who would lead the research teams, and who would yoke their efforts to some more brilliant mind. And finally, the celebration was open to the whole community. In theory, even the greenest scholar-prentice was welcome. In practice, Daffod was not only one of the youngest people there, but also the only scholar-associate attending as a guest. The others of his rank on display that night were scraping up extra allowance by serving drinks and tapas to their betters. Some people wore jackets with formal collars and vests in the colors of their home medry and research conservatories. Others, the undyed summer linens that the newly appointed high magistrate had made fashionable. Daffod was in his formal, a long charcoal jacket over an embroidered shirt and slim-fitting pants. A good outfit, but carefully not too good. Security personnel lurked in the higher status areas, but Daffod walked with the lazy confidence of someone accustomed to access and deference. It would have been trivial to query the local system for the location of Dorinda Alcor, but his aunt might see the request and know he was looking for her. If she had warning, well, better that she didn't. The crowd around him grew almost imperceptibly older as the mix of humanity shifted from scholar-researchers to scholar-coordinators, from support faculty to lead administrators, from recorders and popular writers to politicians and military liaisons. The formal jackets became just slightly better tailored, the embroidered shirts more brightly colored. All the plumage of status on display. He moved up the concentration of power like a microbe heading toward sugar, his hands in his pockets and his smile polite and blank. If he'd been nervous, it would have shown, so he chose to be preoccupied instead. He went slowly, admiring art and icons in the swooping niches of forest coral, taking drinks from the servers and abandoning them to the servers that followed,
being sure he knew what the next room was before he stepped into it. His aunt was on a balcony that looked down over the plaza, and he saw her before she saw him. Her hair was down, in a style that should have softened her face, but the severity of her mouth and jaw overpowered it. Daffod didn't recognize the man she was speaking with, but he was older, with a trim white beard. He was speaking quickly, making small, emphatic gestures, and she was listening to him intently. Daffod made a curve around, getting close to the archway that opened onto the balcony, before changing his stride, moving more directly toward her. She glanced up, saw him. There was only a flicker of frown before she smiled and waved him over. "Muir, this is my nephew, Daffod," she said. "He's working with Tanner Fryce."
"Young Fryce," Trimbeard said, shaking Daffod's hand. "That's a good team to be with. First-rate work."
"I'm mostly preparing samples and keeping the laboratory clean," Daffod said.
"Still, you'll have it on your record. It'll open doors later on. Count on that."
"Muir is with the research colloquy," his aunt said. "Oh," Daffod said and grinned. "Well, then I'm very pleased to meet you indeed. I came to meet with people who could help my prospects. Now that we've met, I can go home." His aunt hid a grimace, but Muir laughed and clapped Daffod on the shoulder.
"Dory here says kind things about you. You'll be fine. But I should..."
He gestured toward the back and nodded to his aunt knowingly. She nodded back, and the older man stepped away. Below them, the plaza was alive. Food carts and a band playing guitar music that gently reached up to where they were standing. Threads of melody floating in the high, fragrant air. She put her arm in his.
"Dory?" Daffod asked.
"I hate it when you're self-effacing," she said, ignoring his attempt at gentle mockery. Daffod noted the tension in her neck and shoulder muscles. Everyone at the party wanted her time and access to the money she controlled. She'd probably been playing defense all night, and it had stolen her patience. "It's not as charming as you think."
"I put people at ease," Daffod said.
"You're at a point in your career that you should make people uneasy. You're too fond of being underestimated. It's a vice. You're going to have to impress someone someday."
"I just wanted to put in an appearance so you'd know I really came."
"I'm glad you did." And her smile forgave him a little.
"You taught me well.
I told my sister I would look out for you, and I swear on her dear departed soul I will turn you into something worthy of her," his aunt said. Daffod flinched at the mention of his mother, and his aunt softened a little. "She warned me that raising children would require patience. It's why I never had any of my own." "I've never been the fastest learner, but that's my burden. Your teaching was always good. I'm going to owe you a lot when it's all said and done."
"No."
"Oh, I'm pretty sure I will. I mean, no. Whatever you're trying to soften out of me, don't ask it. I've been watching you flatter and charm everyone all your life. I don't think less of you for being manipulative. It's a good skill. But I'm better at it than you, so whatever you're about to try to dig out of me, no."
"I met a man from Dian Academy.
I don't think he likes Tanner." She looked at him, her eyes flat as a shark's. Then, a moment later, the same tiny, mirthless smile she had when she lost a hand of cards.
"Don't be smug. I really am glad you came," she said,
then squeezed his arm and let him go. Daffod retraced his steps, through the halls and down the wide ramps. His face shot an empty smile at those he passed, his mind elsewhere. He found Tanner Fryce and Else Yanin on the ground floor in a chamber wide enough to be a ballroom. Tanner had taken his jacket off, and he was leaning on a wide wooden table. Half a dozen scholars had formed a semicircle around him, like a tiny theater with Tanner Fryce as the only man on stage. The thing we'd been doing wrong was trying to build reconciliation strategies at the informational level instead of the product. DNA and ribosomes on one hand, lattice quasi-crystals and QRP on the other. It's like we were trying to speak two different languages and force their grammars to mesh when all we really need are directions on how to build a chair. Stop trying to explain how and just start building the chair and it's much easier. His voice carried better than a singer's. His audience chuckled. David looked around and she was easy to find. Else Yannon, in her emerald green dress, was two tables over. Long, aquiline nose, wide mouth, and thin lips. She was watching her lover with an expression of amused indulgence. Only for a second, Daffod hated Tanner Fryce. He didn't need to do this. No one was asking him to. It would take no extra effort to turn to the right and amble out to the plaza. A plate of roasted corn and spiced beef, a glass of beer, and he could go back to his rooms and let the political intrigue play itself out without him. But Else tucked a lock of auburn hair back behind her ear, and he walked toward her table like he had business there. Small moments, unnoticed at the time, change the fate of empires. Her smile shifted when she saw him. Just as real, but meaning something different. Something more closed. David, I didn't expect to see you here. My other plans fell through, he said, reaching out to a servant passing by with what turned out to be mint iced tea. He'd been hoping for something more alcoholic. I thought I'd see what the best minds of the planet looked like when they let their hair down. Else gestured to the crowd with her own glass. This, on into the small hours of the morning. No dancing? Maybe when people have had a chance to get a little more drunk. There were threads of premature white in her hair. Against the youth of her face, they made her seem ageless. Can I ask you a question? She settled into herself. Of course. Have you heard anything about another group taking over our research? She laughed once, loud enough that Tanner looked over and nodded to David before returning to his performance. You don't need to worry about that, she said. We've made so much progress and gotten so much acclaim in the last year, there's no chance. Anyone who did would be setting themselves up as the disappointing second string. No one wants that. All right, David said, and took a drink of the tea he didn't want. One member of Tanner's little audience was saying something that made him scowl. Else shifted her weight. A single crease drew itself between her eyebrows. Just out of curiosity, what makes you ask? It's just that 100% certainty, no error bars, someone's making a play to take over the research. Else put down her drink and put her hand on his arm. The crease between her eyebrows deepened. What have you heard? David let himself feel a little warmth at her attention, at the touch of her hand. It felt like an important moment, and it was. Later, when he stood in the eye of a storm that burned a thousand worlds, he'd remember how it all started with Else Yannon's hand on his arm and his need to give her a reason to keep it there. Chapter 2. Humans, everyone knew, didn't belong on Ajian. How they'd gotten to the planet, why they'd come there,
All of that was lost in the fog of time and history. A sect of Galatians claimed that they'd arrived on a massive ship like Pishtar's fabled ark, but one that traveled between stars. Sarantist theologians said that God had opened a rift that let the faithful escape the death of an older universe, where some terrible sin, opinions varied on its exact nature, had convinced the deity that genocide was the lesser evil. Or, if you were open to a little more poetry, a giant bird had carried them from Erebi, the planet next closest to the sun, which had possibly been their home world until the sun grew angry and turned their fields to wastelands and boiled away their skies. But the sciences could tell a story too, even if humanity's faulty memory had smeared the details. Life on Agion had begun billions of years before, with a system of aperiodic quasi-crystals of silicon, carbon, and iodine. That life had used the quasi-crystals to pass on instructions to the next generation, with occasional mutations that made some organisms do a little better. Over long eons, a complex ecosystem grew in the Agion Oceans and across its four vast continents. And then, 3,500 years before, and apparently out of nowhere, humans showed up in the fossil record with incredibly dense helical coils of lightly associated bases strung like beads on a necklace of phosphate. And not just humans. Dogs and cows and lettuce and wildflowers and crickets and bees, viruses, mushrooms, squirrels, snails. A whole biome unprecedented in the genetic history of the planet popped into being on an island just east of the Gulf of Daish. Then, barely a century after that first appearance, something, no one was sure what, had turned most of that island into glass and black rock. And while whatever records those original settlers may have brought with them disappeared at that point, a few remnants of this new biome survived at the island's edges and on the nearby continental coastline, and it had spread over the world like a fire. These two trees of life covering the world of Agion usually ignored each other, apart from competing for sunlight and some minerals. Occasionally, something would evolve a way to parasitize creatures from the other biochemical tradition for a few complex proteins, water, and salt. But the common wisdom was that the two biomes couldn't be reconciled in any meaningful way. On a microscopic level, the oaks and alders that were cousins of humanity were just too different from the native Ake and Brulum, no matter how similar they might look from a distance. Even where evolution had guided the shapes and colors and forms into similar solutions, at a fundamental level, the different life forms of Agion could never really nourish each other. Until Tanner Fryce had found a way to translate between them and changed everything. I simultaneously want more beer and also a little less beer than I've already had, Jessen said. Irina, sitting next to her, grinned. The Scholars Common rose up above them at the edge of the plaza. The lights cast up the building's side shifted and pulsed and made the forest coral seem like it was swaying in some vast current. Beyond it, the darkness of the sky and the bright of the stars. Tanner and Els were at the common, being the face of the celebrated team. Kampar, Dafydd, and Ricker were somewhere. There were only four of them at their little table. A casual passerby could have mistaken them for a family. Noel as the craggy-faced, long-suffering father, Sinia as his gray-haired wife, Jessen as the older daughter, and Irina as the younger. It wasn't true at all, except in the ways that it was.
You've probably had enough, hm? Noel said. No call to overdo it.
Irina slapped the table. All call to overdo it. If not now, when?
Noel looked pained and cleared his throat, and Sinia took his arm.
They're young, love. They bounce back faster than we do.
Fair point, fair point, the old scholar associate said.
Jessen still remembered the first time she'd met the team. Tanner Freiss, of course, and Else Yannin, who had just abandoned her own project to join his. Noel had seemed imposing back then, crag-faced and laconic and faintly disapproving. She had expected him and his partner, Sinia, to harbor resentments at being only scholar associates at their age. Instead, she found a kind of profound contentment in them. Despite their status in the Medry, some days it made her question her own ambition.
I'm going back home for a week at the end of break, Irina said. Until then, I have nothing.
Nothing? Sinia asked, but with a twinkle in her eye.
Nothing, Irina said. Nothing and no one. I'm not courting. I'm not finishing an extra run of datasets. I am, for once in my life, relaxing and taking time to recuperate.
Jessen grinned.
You say it now, but you know what'll happen. Tanner is going to have an idea, and when he asks someone to look into it, you're going to show up.
You'll be there too, Irina said. I won't have made a proclamation about not working over break, though.
Irina waved the point away like she was shooing gnats. I'm drunk. Hypocrisy is the natural companion of beer.
Is it? Noel said. I didn't know.
Jessen liked Irina because the junior researcher reminded her not so much of herself at a younger age, but of who she wished she'd been. Smart, pretty, with the first green shoots of self-confidence starting to break through the soil of her insecurities. Jessen liked Daffod, wherever he was tonight, for his quiet utility, and Kampar for his humor, and Ricker for his casual sense of fashion and his cheerful cynicism. And tonight, she loved all of them because they had won. For months, they had worked together in their labs, spent more time there than at their homes. There was a sense of family that grew with exposure, a familiarity that was deeper than just work colleagues. It was the rhythm of intimacy. Without anyone ever making a point of it, Jessen had come to know them all. She could predict when Ricker would want to recheck a protein assay, and when he'd be willing to let a questionable data point stand. Which days Irina would spend quiet and focused, and which she'd be garrulous and distracting. She knew from the taste of the coffee when Daffod had made it, and when it was Sinia. When she wanted to, she could still remember the quiet in the room when the first uptake results had come through. A radioactive marker in a membrane protein that the native Agian biosphere used had shown up in a blade of grass. It was so small, it could have been invisible, and it was also the hinge on which the world swung. Their strange, awkward, haphazard little group had translated one tree of life to the other. Two utterly incompatible methods of heritability had been coaxed into sitting beside one another, working together. That little blade of grass had been the product of a biochemical marriage thousands of years in the making. For an hour, maybe a little less, the nine of them had been the only people in the world who knew about it. As much as their success promised, as many accolades as they'd won, part of Jessen still treasured the magic of that hour. It was a small secret that they'd all shared, an experience they could only speak to each other about, because they were the only ones who really understood the combination of awe and satisfaction.
Even when Jessen told her brother about it, and she told him everything, he could only ever guess what she meant. Across the little square, a band started playing. Two trumpets weaving in and out of synchrony, while a drummer did something that managed to be both propulsive and intricate. Irina grabbed Jessen's hand, tugging her up. Despite her usual reticence, Jessen let herself be pulled. They joined the dance. It was a simple one. They'd all learned the steps in childhood, so they could all recall them in drunken adulthood. Jessen let the music and euphoria carry her. I am part of the most successful research team in the world. I am not too anxious to dance in public. My brain isn't betraying me today. Today is good. When the dance ended, Noel and Sinia had already gone, heading back, Jessen assumed, to the little house they shared on the edge of the Medri's landhold. Irina drank the last of her beer and made a face. Flat? Jessen asked. And warm, but still celebratory. Thank you, by the way. Thank me? Irina looked down at her feet, then up again. She was blushing a little. You and the others were very kind letting me be part of this. We really weren't, Jessen said. You carried your part of the project all the way through. Still, Irina said, then darted forward to kiss Jessen's cheek. Still, thank you. This has been the best year I've ever had. I'm grateful. I am too, Jessen said. And then, as if by mutual understanding, they parted ways. The end-of-year carnival played out in the streets and alleyways. Music and laughter, and the self-important drunken debates of scholars eager to prove to each other that each of them was the cleverest person in the conversation. Jessen walked through the night with her hands in her pockets and a sense of calm. For a moment, she was apart from the Medri, even as she moved within it. In a demi-monde built on status and intellectual prowess, her team was the apex. It wouldn't be forever, but tonight she had won. Tonight she was good enough. Even the dark things in the back of her mind couldn't pull down her mood. The quarters she and her brother shared were in one of the older buildings, not grown coral, but built from glass and stone. She liked it because it was old-fashioned and quiet. Jellit liked it because it was close to his lab and the noodle shop he frequented. Jellit wasn't there. His work group were having their own celebration, no doubt. He'd be back by morning, or he'd send her a message to let her know he was falling in bed with someone and not to expect him. He wouldn't just vanish and leave her to worry. She sat at their table, deciding whether she wanted food before she went to bed or just a tall glass of water. She found herself grinning. It was so rare to feel satisfied. It was so odd to know for certain that she'd done well. Tanner Freis and Els Janin, Ricker, Kampar, Irina, Noel, Sinia, and even, in his way, David Alcor. The team that had cracked open the possibility of a new, integrated biology. Generations from now, the textbooks would talk about them and what they'd done. Her system alerted. A message waiting for her. She expected it would be Jellit, but the flag was from Tanner Freis. When his face appeared on the screen, Jessen sobered. She'd seen his moods before enough to recognize rage. Jessen, I need you to come to an emergency meeting tomorrow at the lab, and don't mention it to anyone. Chapter 3. The Medri's laboratories had an eerie emptiness. Daffod walked through the flowing hallways and galleries and meeting spaces that during the year were busy with scholars and artisan fabricators and on-site representatives of the colloquies. They were almost abandoned now. A pair of men in hard, plasticized coveralls were repainting one of the walls. A harried man sped by on some past-due errand. A sparrow that had found its way inside fluttered down the empty air of the halls, looking for scraps of food or a way out. A scholar associate, who Daffod recognized from the architectural chitin project, sat alone on a bench with her sandwich and an inward expression. And, in a little impromptu circle of three couches in one chair outside the closed commissary, a council of war. Tanner and Else shared a couch, sitting together, but not together, the space between them an equilibrium of intimacy and professionalism. Kampar was sprawled on a couch of his own, large, dark, and scruffy. He looked amused and sleepy in equal measure, like a children's cartoon of a bear. Beside him, sitting primly on the one chair, craggy head covered with salt and pepper stubble, Noel. Daffod looked around for the others, but there was no sign of them. As he took his place on the empty couch, Noel nodded toward him.
"Are we all?" Daffod asked.
"Jessen's on her way," Tanner said. The smiling, confident version of him from the Scholar's Common was gone. His eyes were dark as a storm, and his jaw was tight. Anyone who'd spent the last year watching the weather of Tanner's internal life would know that the best thing now was to be quiet and wait.
"Sinia is at home," Noel said. "She wasn't feeling well. I don't know about Ricker or Irina."
When Tanner spoke, the words were icy and careful. "I thought we wouldn't bother them with this just yet." Daffod felt a little shiver go down his back. Kampar made a soft, impatient sound and lolled his head to the side.
"The tension is unbearable. What exactly is it that we're not talking about?"
"Jessen will be here soon," Tanner said. Else shifted her attention to Daffod, her eyes meeting his for a moment and then clicking away, like they were hiding a secret. But, sadly, the only secret they shared was the one Tanner was about to tell everyone else, too. The first sign of Jessen was her brother's voice, enthusiastic and loud. A moment later, they rounded the corner. Jessen was short, round-bodied, and severe. Jellet was lanky and colt-awkward, with a grin that matched his voice. Other than that, they were almost the same person, gold-brown skin, black hair and eyes. They both had moles on their right cheeks, like it was a little flourish that the gods of genetics and development had chosen to use for a signature. They moved their hands the same way, shrugged with the same left then right. Daffod liked Jessen, and so, by extension, he liked her brother. They were like two halves of the same organism. Something had Jellet excited. He was gesturing wide-handed as they drew closer. "As extrasolar activity goes, it's as strange as anything anyone's seen. There's one data set that made it look superluminal, but no one thinks that's anything but a glitch." He turned to greet them, and his face fell. "We were just walking together," Jessen said, sitting on the couch at Daffod's side. "Is this a team meeting?" Jellet said. And then, before anyone could answer, "I'm just going to get some tea then. I'll see you back at home."
"See you there," Jessen said to her brothers already retreating back. Her sigh was almost imperceptible, and certainly not conscious. She turned to Tanner. "I'm sorry to be late."
"Superluminal?"
Kampar asked, lifting one shaggy eyebrow. Jellit has a perverse fondness for obviously bad data, Jessen said. He thinks it's funny because it makes the research colloquy uncomfortable. Kumpar chuckled. I find your brother's air of charming perversity intriguing. He's still single, isn't he? No dating my brother, Jessen said. It was a running joke between them. Thank you all for coming during the break. I'm sorry to interrupt what should be some well-earned relaxation, Tanner said, ending the banter. They all turned toward him like he was a lecturer and they were his audience. Else's face was calm and impassive and focused on Tanner as though she didn't already know what he was about to say. She did, though. Daffod would have bet money on it. We have a problem. Someone has asked the funding colloquy to reassign our work. Jessen paled. Kumpar sat forward, the playfulness and good humor that usually marked him gone like it had never been there. Only Noel didn't change his expression or posture, just giving a little nod like he'd been expecting the universe to disappoint him somehow. He was, however, the first to gather himself enough to speak.
Do we know the reason for it? Are we being punished for something?
Tanner glanced at Else, passing the focus of attention to her. Daffod wondered whether they had rehearsed this, or if they were just well enough attuned to each other that it came without thought. As far as we can tell, she said, the argument is that our work is too important to keep in only one place and with only a single team. The primary scholars would be loaned to other medri and collegia to start up parallel programs, with one of the junior researchers left here to shepherd the work that's already in progress. Kumpar's laugh was loud and bitter. Too loud, maybe. Daffod looked around, but the only one nearby was the girl with the sandwich, and she wasn't looking toward them. A junior scholar taking over and kicking the high and mighty into the cold, Kumpar said. Someone stabbed us in the back, but I'll swear to any god you like that it ain't me. There's no question this begins with someone in our inner circle, Tanner said. But we have reason to think the plan was submitted by someone connected to Dian Academy.
What reason? Noel asked. If you don't mind.
Else gestured toward Daffod, and the group's attention turned to him. I met a man at the Scholars Common, Daffod said. Lauren Morse. He's in near-field astronomical visualization, but he knew something was coming. He was gloating. And he was from Dian. So then I caught one of the senior administrators a little by surprise, and she made a little too much effort in not saying anything about it.
Even if that's true, it doesn't prove a connection to Dian Academy. Not really, Noel said. This Morse could have known through other paths. Jellit works near field also, yes? Jessen here could have formulated the plan and let it slip to her brother.
Jessen made an angry snort. Noel patted the air placatingly.
Not saying it's you. Hell, I could have made the plan myself. I know people at Dian.
Yes, it's only our best guess hypothesis, Donner said. We will confirm or eliminate. And I managed to find out who was slated for the three spin-off labs. Me, Else, and Jessen. So no, I don't think it was her. Kumpar already has a placement in Burson that he's been delaying to help us finish first phase, so I see no reason to think it's him. Noel pursed his lips in disapproval, but didn't object further.
Irina?
Kumpar said. She did her first term at Dian. But I wouldn't like to think... It isn't her, Jessen said. She wouldn't do that. And this is her first team. We're all junior researchers, but she's barely more than an assistant. She flickered with embarrassment as soon as she'd said it, her gaze darting toward Daffod and then Noel, then away again. Ricker's father is a landgraf near Dian, Else said. The Academy gets a tenth of its buildings from him. It's not conclusive, but He seems most likely.
I'd hate to jump to conclusions, Kumpar said. I think it's only professional that we find him and beat the truth out of him, yes?
Jessen said, Are we certain that opening new projects is a bad idea? The group stuttered into quiet, and she opened her hands. It's a power grab. I understand that. It's bad for us, each of us, all of us individually, at least in the short term. But what if it's good for the project? 4 coordinating labs? That could be huge. I mean, don't we want to steer research at other places? Inspire other projects? What does winning look like if it doesn't look like this?
The team scattered to the winds is a strange look for victory, Noel said, with a gentle bitterness. Pretending to enjoy the sandwich its host is eating, the swarm jitters and presses, its myriad dancing senses focused on the little group. The flesh that it occupies once belonged to a woman named Amir Kindred, who is both dead and not dead now. The swarm is aware of the food in the host's mouth, aware that Amir once enjoyed the taste. It frees up some of its control over the woman's face so that her pleasure can change her features appropriately. The swarm, who is both Amir Kindred and not Amir Kindred, understands a bit more of what it means to enjoy food and files this information away for later use. The instruction set that defines the swarm's mission is far too complex to represent as simple rules. But if it could be, then rule number 1 would be remain hidden. Anything that allows it to mimic human interactions with their environment is vital to its success. Focusing its attention on the targets, the swarm thrusts a million tiny needles like antennae through the host's skin, and these new nodes quiver with hunger to see, hear, taste them. 2 members of the group it already knows from the announcements. Tonner Freis, the leader and figurehead, the highest status researcher in the world at this singular, critical moment, and the other one at his side, Else Yannin, who has the 2nd highest status in the group. The swarm shifts its awareness to pheromones, opening new channels on Amir Kindred's skin to drink in the subtlest human sense. Fear, anger, anxiety, lust, sorrow. So many chemical signals pouring off the little knot of bodies. Amir knows what those emotions mean. Her memory is full of those feelings and the causes of them. And so the swarm knows those things too. And the matrices of data that represent its understanding of the target group's social dynamic are enriched by this knowledge. The swarm feels something Amir would identify as satisfaction at this increasingly sophisticated flow of information. 2 of the group arrive, smelling very nearly the same, a male and female pair. Genetically related, the swarm calculates. Brother and sister, Amir thinks, and the swarm adds this information to the data. The swarm shifts to focus on hearing. Amir Kindred's skin tightening like a drum skin underneath the myriad protruding metal hairs to make her flesh into a girl-shaped ear, and the male of the sibling pair's voice is now like a shout. As extrasolar activity goes, it's as strange as anything anyone's seen, he says. There's one data set that made it look superluminal. The swarm is not capable of feeling fear, but it does now feel a heightened sense of pressure. It knows there is very little time left. The male sibling walks away. He isn't a part of this work group. The swarm disregards him.
shifting its study, finding the new and necessary skin that will allow it to continue its mission. They speak, and it listens to them speak, but its senses are rich and strange. It finds patterns in their heartbeats that they themselves cannot know. It maps the connections of one to another, like water finding a way to seep through stone. It understands in ways that may be useful to it, or may not. What is not useful will be abandoned, forgotten, annihilated. A mere kindred senses the swarm's intention. She knows her time as the host is coming to an end, and though she has screamed her hatred of the swarm's invasion of her body and thoughts every second of every day since it took over, Amir also understands that the swarm will not leave her alive when it moves on. The thought of her own impending death is like an ocean of sorrow. This sadness is not currently useful to the swarm, so it files it away and then ignores it. Are we certain that opening new projects is a bad idea? The remaining half of the sibling pair says, and the swarm watches, and it waits. It cannot afford to wait much longer.
The team scattered to the winds is a strange look for victory, Noel said with a gentle bitterness.
Jessen shrugged, an almost microscopic gesture, but she didn't look away. Tanner stood. If Daffod had been under his gaze, he'd have shrunk back, but Jessen didn't.
If you want your own lab, I'm sure you can get one, he said. This is not the way I intend to lose mine.
Damn right, Kampar said. I intend to be lured away with promises of wealth and power as tradition demands.
But Tanner's focus was entirely on Jessen. Daffod watched the two implacabilities face each other like a blowtorch on stone. Else said Tanner's name, but it might have been from a different room. The silence between the two scholars stretched long past comfort, and the stone cracked before the flame died out. Jessen looked away.
I see your point, she said.
Daffod exhaled. Tanner, scowling now, got up and started pacing through the little space like the confrontation had left him restless. Kampar caught Daffod's gaze and mouthed,
Daddy's angry.
We have a window of opportunity, Tanner said. If we find which of the team is behind this, there may be leverage we can bring to bear. Even if they withdraw the plan, there may be some enthusiasm for it in the colloquy. You can help with that, Daffod.
I will do what I can, he said, not promising anything. He could already imagine the conversation with his aunt and how delicate a job it would be.
Else and Kampar can look into Irina, just to be sure it isn't her. Jessen and Noel will see about our friend Ricker.
Why us? Noel asked. Not that I disagree, you know, just...
Jessen can use the connection with Jellet to sound out Lauren Morse, Daffod said. They're both near field. End of year makes it easy to reach out. Tanner.